Hi, this is Paul. One of the upsides of puppy prison that I'm in right now, and what I mean by that is that we have this puppy, and until it's fully vaxxed, it has to stay home, and my wife just started the new year, so I'm back in my old homeschooling schedule. But what that means is that I get a little chance to do some reading. Cale Zeldin sent me this piece that he said was making the rounds in Roman Catholic circles, and I found it to be a very interesting piece. It's entitled, Can Hermetic Magic Rescue the Church? Part 1, Acknowledge the Crisis and Breaking the Spell. Now, there's a John Vervaeke sighting towards the end of this piece, which we'll sort of get to. But it's the piece really captured my attention, and I think it goes far beyond the Roman Catholic Church, but it touched on a number of things that I've been thinking about while in puppy prison. The theologian Karl Rahner may have done more to undermine the integrity of Catholic orthodoxy at the highest level of theological scholarship than any other member among the Nouvelle Théologie Cognoscenti. Although it's difficult to say who deserves the particular accolades that the 20th century provides so much competition, be that as it may, this is from the European conservative, so it gives you a sense of where they're speaking from. Be that as it may, Rahner famously made the remark, with which I found myself in increasing agreement as time rolls on and the decay of institutional Christianity is ever more evident. The Christian of the future will be a mystic or will not exist at all. Now, I should say that I was talking to Rick Lilla, who, I don't know if I should mention, I don't think he'd have any problem mentioning his name. He's a regular listener, and he was at both Thunder Bay and Chino. He's older than I am, and in Thunder Bay he played paintball with us, and I was tremendously impressed at just his gumption and determination. I had a wonderful conversation with him there. He recommended two books to me, which I actually picked up right away. Both of them are by Jason Baxter, An Introduction to Christian Mysticism and The Medieval Mind of C.S. Lewis. I had some extra Audible credits, and listening to Audible book while I watch the puppy do nothing is actually not too bad of a use of time. And I've started both books on Audible, probably am a little bit more interested in the Lewis book. Lewis, his introduction to Lewis, I thought was quite good. In the early 1960s, the editor of the Christian Century sent a question to 100 of the most famous literary and intellectual personalities of the day. Which books did most to shape your vocational attitude and your philosophy of life? The editors were trying to map the books that shaped the minds of their generation. C.S. Lewis was among the polled. By that time, Lewis had already been famous for 2 decades as a novelist, essayist, and theologian, as Christian Century summed him up, curiously leaving out something he considered essential to his intellectual identity. He was particularly admired for the Screwtape Letters, his Warriors broadcast Mere Christianity, and for his innovative fictional writing, especially Chronicles of Narnia, published throughout the 1950s. Already in September 1947, been on the cover of Time magazine, yada, yada, yada. And over those years, he had spent 2 hours a day patiently responding to letters that poured in from his devoted admirers from across the Anglophone world. He had hosted journalists seeking interviews with him and had accepted dozens of invitations to give lectures and sermons. And some, his cultural standing was found on his perceived mastery of psychology, his ability to recast Christianity imaginatively in myth, and for his work in apologetics. As Rowan Williams, summing up 50 years of admiration, put it, Lewis's gift was what you might call pastoral theology, as an interpreter of people's moral and spiritual crises, as someone who is brilliant, a brilliant diagnostician of self-deception. But there was, as his friend Owen Barfield once said, a third Lewis. In addition to the Christian apologist, those sagacious words delivered over radio waves have been so comforting during England's darkest hour. In addition to Lewis the mythmaker, the creator of Narnia and Fantastic Tales of Space Adventure, there was Lewis the scholar, the Oxford and later Cambridge Don, who spent his days lecturing students on medieval cosmology and his nights looking up old words in dictionary. This Lewis, as Louis Marcos put, was far more a man of the medieval age than he was of our own. This was the man who read 14th century medieval texts for his spiritual reading, carefully anecdoting annotating them with pencil, who summed himself up as a chiefly a medievalist, a philologist who wrote essays on semantics, metaphors, etymologies, and textual reception. The distinguished Oxford Don, a literary critic, who packed lecture theaters with his unscripted reflections on English literature, the schoolmaster who fussed at students for not looking up treacherous words in their lexicon, the polyglot pedant who did not translate his quotations from medieval French, German, Italian, and ancient Latin and Greek. If you've only read C.S. Lewis's popular books, you should dive into some of the books that were more on the academic side, because what they're saying is true, and they're hard sledding just to go through for a lot of these reasons. Before he was famous as a Christian and a writer of fantasy, he was famous among his students for his academic lectures. He wrote such scintillating titles as Prolegomena to Medieval Literature and Prolegomena to Renaissance Literature long before he ever thought of defending Christianity. I'm not getting to the place that I want. It was this professorial Lewis who in 1955 letter lamented that modern renderings of old poems made up a dark conspiracy to convince the modern barbarian that the poetry of the past was, in his own day, just as mean, colloquial, and ugly as our own. That was Lewis the antiquarian, who devoted much, indeed most of his life, to breathing in the thoughts and feelings of distant ages and reconstructing them to teaching and writing. Now, this goes on for a while. The purpose that and he makes his argument, you know, he loved to make lists. Among the 10 books Lewis cited in helping shape his sense of vocation and his philosophy of life, there are some we would expect and some we wouldn't. They were George MacDonald's Phantastes, G.K. Chesterton's Everlasting Man, Virgil's Aeneid, George Herbert's The Temple, William Wordsworth's Prelude, Rudolf Otto's The Idea of the Holy, Boethius's Consolation of Philosophy, Boswell's Life of Johnson, Charles Williams' Descent into Hell, and Arthur James Balfour's Theism and Humanism. Now, of course, some of those were more recent, but many of them were ancient. And part of the reason I make this comment in conjunction with this piece that Cale sent me is that I think we're striving for the words. All of the words have their own pitfalls. And I think mysticism is a fair word. Now, if you go into Jason Baxter's An Introduction to Christian Mysticism, he recognizes the problem right away with the word because he teaches students. And now this is published by Baker Academic, so it's not going to be terribly far off the beaten path. But he, you know, in the introduction here too, he very much gets into, well, what on earth do we mean by mysticism? And I think he has a pretty good definition of it. We are now ready to take our first shot at answering the question, what is mysticism? Maybe it's better to start with what mysticism is not. It's not about voices or visions. It's not about whimsical or capricious shakerism in which you are violently seized with personal revelation. Rather, it's the fruit of love and virtue and patience and diligence in prayer and discipleship. Mysticism is about God, beauty, prayer, and the depth of the soul. Through the careful development of character and the training of the mind, it aims to achieve an intellectual vision, that is, unmediated contact with God. But this intellectual vision is hard to win. Technically, you can't win it at all. It's a gift. Nevertheless, to achieve this intellectual vision, to get to the high point of your soul, as Augustine put it, you have to pass through the prior stages of purgation of the heart, purgation of the mind, until the practice of charity, including intellectual charity, becomes natural. In this way, mysticism is a rational, ethical, and systematic preparation for an experience of the fullness of God. And I thought that was really a lovely definition. Now, this writer goes on, says to say a lot that's, he clearly isn't a fan of the current Pope. But a lot of what he points to goes far beyond this Pope and very much goes to this age. Since the late 19th century, the faithful have been subjected to even more regular and even longer papal encyclicals and exhortations. Under the current pontiff, these have taken the form of very long essays, mostly comprising observations and occasional hints at the revolutionary direction beneath their authorship. It's almost as if the present Holy Father is begging to be taken seriously by the faithful for a moment, as he feigns speaking to them on equal footing. This, though, is not at all how he actually governs the Church, bypassing canon law and settled theology as he pleases, and persecuting those members of the faithful who won't, so to speak, get with the program. This, of course, is exactly what belongs to the psychology of an abusive man. Ouch. He oscillates from begging to be loved and listened to throwing his fists around. I thought that was a very interesting observation. And I'm not a very close Pope watcher, but from the little I know, I thought, that might be right. A central reason why abusive people behave this way is because they have lost authority. They can no longer be believed or trusted, and so they resort to begging, sentimental gestures, and then to violence. That's very true. The hierarchy of the Church has almost entirely lost authority in the eyes of the rest of the faithful. This isn't a speculative deduction offered in some attempt to explain the phenomena. What I am describing is the situation as it is, a matter of fact. Among the vocal, active Catholics of the second half of the 20th century, there were broadly three factions: the progressives, the trads, and the post-conciliar neocons. The third category was dominant until the reign of Pope Francis, but since then has nearly totally disappeared. The champions of the hermeneutic of continuity have, generally speaking, fallen silent. It was too difficult to keep up. Francis has demonstrated that the post-conciliar age is an age of ecclesiastical and theological rupture, and to argue that this isn't the case has become impossible. The neocons tried to maintain their position for the first 5 years of Francis's papacy, attempting to render orthodox every one of his bizarre allocutions. But in the end, it was just too tiring and too embarrassing. Among vocal, active Catholics, there now remain two dominant groups, the progressives and the trads. Neither of these groups has much confidence in the authority of the Holy See or the Curia. The progressives never believed that the law of the Church, the dogmas of the faith, or the moral law that had claim on their intellectual and conscience in any case, beyond what they individually choose to accept. The trads always believed they were bound by some things, but see now that some things happened to the Church government that made it no longer trustworthy, and thus they look sideways at anything coming out of Rome. The progressives are happy to affirm the Church's authority at present, but only because it serves their ideology to do so. They are certainly more reluctant under John Paul II and Benedict XVI. What this means is that neither of the two dominant groups of vocal, active Catholics trust the hierarchy's authority merely on the grounds that it belongs to the government of a divine institution. Thus, the Church is, as a matter of fact, in a post-authority epoch. And I thought, that is deeply, deeply true. Now, of course, I'm a Protestant, and so Protestants don't think that way. Our break came 500 years ago or less, and so, of course, this is part of what's going on. Now, the whole article I found really quite this section was amazing too. Since the late medieval period, every form of check and balance in the Church has increasingly diminished. The influence of temporal power of the Church, namely the laity, on ecclesiastical matters has so ebbed that the laity now has no influence whatsoever. The clerical hierarchy, especially the Pope, is now totally unchecked. If the Pope has an idea, he can type it out on a piece of paper, put his name at the bottom of it, and suddenly it becomes law. And that's exactly how Pope Francis governs the Church. The situation is ridiculous, and again, has corroded to the point of destroying the last residue of authority in the Church. In the so-called age of ecclesiastical congeniality, there is zero collegiality. The whole thing is a smokescreen exercise. Attempting to make sense of this situation, the faithful have increasingly fallen back into the sensus fidelium to tap into, so to speak, the true faith of the ages that is being covered up with recurrent acts of clerical voluntarism. The church's government knows that this is what is happening, and thus is diabolically seeking to imitate the sensus fidelium through the synodical process, so that it appears that the sense of the faithful conveniently affirms the revolutionary direction of the governing clergy. Over the last century, the church has undergone the greatest apostasy in its history, and yet amazingly, people are still sporadically converting to Catholicism. And again, this is what we're seeing. In the West, such people, especially young people, are coming to the Catholic Church through the traditional liturgy and wider trad movement. Indeed, strange characteristics of the post-authority epoch is that the parish and the diocese isn't really where Catholicism happens. That line, Catholicism has largely become an internet genre, as has, to a certain degree, I mean, obviously the Catholic Church is far, 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 far larger than the cadre of people who have come in that are very much like this little corner. Same with Orthodoxy, but I think the same thing can probably be said of Orthodoxy. And whilst the Christian government is doing all it can from the very top to destroy the trad movement, it certainly remains alive and well online. It is mainly by its virtual world that young people come to Catholicism in their attempt to escape the Manichaean and nihilism of late modernity, which mainstream Catholicism only appears to offer in ceremonial form. On the arrival into the fold, however, such young people find that their new spiritual fathers wish they'd never become Catholics. Having escaped the world that tried to ruin their souls, they find themselves in a church that officially wishes they'd never existed. It's a remarkable thing. And, you know, it makes me, of course, think about Rod Dreher's, started as a Methodist, went to the Catholics, of course, had that run-in with the priest, and then went to Orthodoxy. So I'm sure plenty of people could point to plenty of things in it. We must spiritually engage with the situation at hand as the West continues to plummet into its now unavoidable civilizational collapse. We shall see the rise of all kinds of superstitions and witchcrafts, which will likely serve to bestow a religious character upon the technocratic age of biogovernment and transhumanism that we've now entered. The church's hierarchy has not only shown every sign of celebrating this diabolic trajectory, which it doesn't even begin to understand, but even if it became critical of it, it remains completely unequipped to engage with the new global regime in the prophetic way that we've desperately needed. Those who see that we're in for something quite different in the interminable capital P progress that liberalism promises to deliver are increasingly looking for a spiritual awakening that will reconcile us to God and to his creation that we've defaced, and the church stands at the sidelines looking baffled at such people. And again, you know, of course, Lewis became, you know, a loyal churchman in the Anglican Church. And people are loyal to the church, but does the church have any way of understanding them? The West is entrenched in what the philosopher and psychologist John Vervaecius called a meaning crisis, whilst the institutional church has entered into an authority crisis. I submit that the church's reclaiming of its mission is the only way out of the meaning crisis of the West, a crisis that the West has successfully exported to almost every part of the globe, and at present the church remains utterly unfit to take up this mission. It's quite a piece. I'll put the link below in the notes, and if I forget, leave a comment so that I get reminded to put it in there. This is, of course, all about plausibility structures, and every now and then something catches my imagination and I think, oh, it's in this video around this time, and I remember wrong. And so then I wind up looking for the dumb thing seemingly forever, But while I'm looking through stuff, I find other stuff. It's like, oh yeah, I'm glad I rewatched this video because this was really important. Yeah, back to this video. This is a great video.
So, yeah, along comes the Protestant Reformation, right? And the result of the Reformation, and it has to be remembered that the Reformation took place in Germany, right? It was primarily, in its beginnings, primarily a German religious movement, right? Obviously, it goes to France and Switzerland and England, other places, but originally it's primarily a German religious movement, except that the Reformation didn't take place in Germany because Germany did not exist. Germany is a made-up country. Fake news, everybody. Germany's a made-up country, right? There, if you look at a medieval map, there's no Germany on that map. Nobody who lived in the place that we call Germany now would have called themselves Germans. Actually, they still don't call themselves Germans. But a really fun game is actually what's the name of German in other languages, and like every I don't know, what do you guys call it in French?
Allemand.
Yeah, right. Because like the Alemanne region, right? Right. So it's nobody who lived there called themselves Germans, right? But Germany is a modern construct.
Yeah.
But the way that it was built, the story sort of begins in the Protestant Reformation. I don't have like a ton of time to go into this, but let's say that as a result of the Protestant Reformation, we got something called the 30 Years' War in Western Europe, which is one of the bloodiest periods in Western Europe. Actually, not the Middle Ages, right? But this is now in the modern period.
Now, I want to add a little nuance to this, because if you tell the story this way, it's tempting to say, well, if it hadn't been the Protestant Reformation, then we wouldn't have had the 30 Years' War, and then we wouldn't have all these problems. Well, I think the story is way more complex than that. Again, going back to Carlos Erie's book, Reformations, it's helpful to remember you have the Columbian Exchange in 1492 with Columbus opening up the Americas. The world was changing. And this local world of medievalism was breaking down, and this vast church that was over Christendom, the great Latin church. I mean, that was in many ways a civilization, but it was a civilization that managed somehow to have the global and the local in a fairly well connected hierarchy up and down. And one way or another, this was going to break down. And if you read something like Dominion or Tom Holland's earlier book, Millennium, I forget what it is, in the it's got different names in the UK and the US. There's an ongoing battle between the king and the pope, let's say, the king of the church and the king of the kingdom. A long going struggle between these two powers. And so part of what happens when there's a big shakeup of the plausibility structure in what would become Germany. It was the Holy Roman Empire, of course. What would become Germany, and then of course it doesn't stay there. It goes to Switzerland, which is sort of part of the German world, but also part of the French world, because of course Geneva is part of French Switzerland, but then of course to England, and via England out to the New World in the Americas. It's a much bigger story in terms of what's happening in terms of this breakdown.
30 Years' War, incredibly bloody struggle between Roman Catholics and Protestants over basically a very small slice of Western Europe.
Yeah.
And the end result of the 30 Years' War is something called the Treaty of Westphalia. And one of the things that comes about as a result of that treaty is that they decide, okay, your religion will be determined simply by whatever principality you live in. So like if you live in this little province, and some of these are quite small, basically the size of what in Texas would be a county. I don't know. Do you guys call them parishes or counties, or Like, what's the unit in Canada beyond the city?
Yeah, we do have something like that. I forget what they're called. Yeah,
okay.
We have county. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, county. Yeah, yeah. So, but basically, these very small principalities, and your religion, if you lived there, would just be whatever the official, whatever the religion yeah. of. And so, what happened was that instead of the identity conferred by the Christian story being kind of the at the very outside level, is that it collapsed down actually several levels into the hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
And so it goes from being, here's a universalizing story of Passion Week and Pascha, right? Of Rome and Greece, of the Trojan War and, you know, St. John the Baptist, right? All these things, like, this is our universalizing story that kind of is the container that holds everything together. And now that collapses, actually several rungs down the ladder, right? To now, it's actually secondary to your political identity.
Mm-hmm.
Now, once you...
Now, yes, but it doesn't... I mean, the Treaty of Westphalia doesn't sort of just resolve the situation, because very quickly you're going to have the development of religious liberty, which is what he's going to talk about, because that doesn't break down. The prince or the king in charge of the religion, England, of course, the king or prince in charge of the religion doesn't really sort of hold it together. And of course, this goes all the way back to Constantine and the struggle that happens then. And in a sense, you sort of have the power of the sword and the power of the spirit. It's almost, you know, two rival, it's almost upper and lower register that are vying for power. But again, the main argument, if you're going to make the argument in very short term, of course, it's far more complex, and what Jonathan is about to say in a few minutes reveals that to be so, because even though you had sort of a globalizing, totalizing story, it was also local. And because in many ways the enchantments were local, and so you had little saints around, and so it's an enormously complex, integrated, messy mishmash that the church sort of gives a global roof over, but how everyone is living in their own little places, well, there's theme and variations.
Kind of understand when that happened and how that happened, you can then understand how it's actually a pretty short trip to go from there to now my religious identity or my spiritual identity or whatever is something that I confer upon myself.
Yeah, it's
now
a personal thing.
Right? Yeah, but also, like, but it...
because of course it's uncompelling when, let's say, the king so obviously, say, breaks relations with Rome because he needs an heir. I mean, and what that then caused, of course, in England was fracturing. And then once, of course, at first Henry VIII was against the Reformation, and then he follows suit with it, in a way, in his own way, and so. Kings will make uncompelling popes. I'll say it that way. And when the maybe you'll tolerate the prince monkeying around with getting a priest in, because sort of at that level, the prince, if he's a good prince, maybe knows what a good priest looks like and is going to make sure that system works well, and maybe if the church structure is working well, they'll help the government structure work well. In other words, if there's wisdom and goodwill and all of that, the two structures can theoretically help each other, and over Christian history they have. This is a very, very large story we're trying to sort of wrap our minds around.
Isn't that also, like, political identity also has collapsed down to that level now?
Yeah.
So you can freely associate with whatever political party you want, at least in some parts of the world. But
right. So what happens with politics and religion that are really so close? Remember, religion is dollars, politics is cents. Politics is now, religion is always. Because what a religion really is how the world works. It's your worldview. It's your basic interpretation for what it means to make life work. And this is why religion is, on one hand, utterly pragmatic, which means that miracles are always a big deal because people always need them. And so the religion that offers the most plausible and realistic miracles is probably going to be the religion that wins. But sort of, if you've been following some of my Sunday sermons, at the same time, miracles don't always happen. And so what Christianity manages to do is, on one hand, afford compelling miracles. And the church is still doing this in terms of, let's say, Pentecostals, afford compelling miracles. But also, on the other hand, when the miracle doesn't come, when the Messiah is crying out, my God, why have you forsaken me? And the Father doesn't rush down and release the Son from the cross. The religion that actually offers potency in suffering and character and plausibility, whether the miracle comes or not, that religion is going to have tremendous power. And so this transformation that happens, of course, is connected up to all the other transformations of the Enlightenment and of the skepticism and of challenging the rot of corruption and, you know, ecclesiastical abuse, and I mean, all of these things. And so, you know, all of these things have been working for over 500 years in the West. And again, I think this telling of the story, the way that Richard is doing it, is very helpful. But of course, and I think both of them will admit, the story is just far, far larger. Plus, you know, at the end of the Middle Ages, you're going to have this population explosion in Europe. You're going to have the rise eventually of the nation state, because the nation state is, as Jonathan is about to say, is far more than just a big kingdom. There's all this new technology that's going to come online, political technology, military technology. I mean, everything in Europe is going to change. And of course, Napoleon is going to bring this sea change in Europe.
But, you know, talking to the United States, you can freely associate with whatever political party you want. And everything about your identity has collapsed down to the level of the self. So when all of this is going on, though, and before it kind of gets all the way down to that level, primarily in 18th and 19th century Europe, you have the emerging of what is sometimes called the search for the national epic.
Yeah.
So why do we need the national epic? Because we're not part of an empire anymore, Holy Roman or otherwise. We're not part of an empire anymore. And we're not part of, and we're not even part of the same religion anymore, right? Nowadays, Protestants, Roman Catholics.
Now, the real question is, what in fact is our religion? What is this operating system that we are working? Because this is one thing that Lewis, you know, thoroughly understood, as did Tolkien, and what it takes to actually engage in the religious conversation, to engage in what the real religion is. And this is where we go back to the Tom Holland stuff with the classical periods and the Greeks and the Romans, because of course religion for them was, you know, the practice of the sacrifices and stuff, but we see that as something apart. You can live just fine without religion, all the atheists say, until, of course, all these other little things come up. It's sort of like saying you can live just fine on a diet of exclusively McDonald's hamburgers until you can't. And what we learn is that the frame of reference can't just be one little life. It's lives in relation to each other, because we're deeply wed with each other. And it's one generation after the other, because often, unlike, let's say, a diet primarily of McDonald's hamburgers that might show up within 20 or 30 years, what's happening is that we're working with other systems that the malady of which might only show up with respect to the time frame of centuries. And in fact, religion is a very important thing because it has been something that has been molded within sort of that clock speed, within that time frame. And so I think that's part of the reason that religious people tend to outperform other people in terms of happiness and generosity and many of the values that religions tend to characterize. And of course, if you listen to the rough draft for Sunday will have been out on Saturday already. These things are deeply in our culture already. But this basic operating system that is our religion is a lot more than just, whether you're going to church or not going to church. It's a lot more than just how you identify verbally. It's all of the deep manners and modes of trust by which you deal both with keeping body and soul together for you as an individual, but also keeping a flourishing community together that you need to sort of make sense of the world, because of course we're obviously all making sense through each other.
Catholics, Orthodox, like we can go out together and we can have a beer and we can talk about our differences and all these different things. Nobody stabs anybody, and that's great. I love that. Don't get me wrong. But if you think for a moment that somebody, in the 30 Years' War believed that, the Roman Catholic over there and me, we're the same religion, basically, and we're just quibbling over a few small differences, this is not how people thought.
Yeah.
And he's exactly right. And part of the reason that we get along so well together, until we don't, I can get along so well together with all of the people who vote the same way I do, or I get along so well together with all the people who aspire and have the same stars and ideals that I do. Maybe it's you love Trump or you love Biden, or you're a fiercely independent who says plague on both their houses or whatever, is because there are many other things happening underneath in the operating system. And again, this stuff is so enormously complex. First of all, we're only marginally in tune with what's going on. Just a bunch of people have been mentioning Rick Rubin, and I didn't even know who the guy was, and so I looked him up and thought, boy, he's exactly my age. And he grew up in the New York metropolitan area. And truth be told, if I let my hair grow, we might look a lot alike. I didn't see that he was married. I don't know if my wife would let me get quite to that degree. She doesn't put many constraints on how I look, but she can have influence when she basically practices the 1 minute manager with how I look. And if you don't know what the 1 minute manager is, it's a management strategy that basically says, don't carp on people for always doing the wrong thing. That actually doesn't really work well. What you should do is catch them in the act of doing the right thing and praise them for it. It's basically positive reinforcement. But he says this at the beginning of his conversation with Lex Fridman, and I'm gonna watch a few of his things as I'm in puppy prison again next week.
Right answers for anything involved in art. We're all trying experiments to find a way. And even for the things that I work on, I don't have a set way that I do anything. I come to every project blank.
Maybe you're just a meat vehicle and you're channeling ideas from somewhere else.
I believe.
Wow, Lex, that's quite a phrase.
We know close to nothing about anything. If we embrace that not knowing, we'll have a healthier experience going through life.
And of course you can take that too far in the wrong way, but he's got a point that the point of combinatorial explosiveness is really a powerful one, because we have all of these shortcuts and these ways of sort of targeting each other and figuring the way things out, but you push them too hard in almost any direction and they sort of give way.
They weren't killing each other over small differences, let's say. So anyway, so you're not held together by the same religion anymore, and you're not held together by the same and you're not even held together by like the sort of like the imperial story, right? And so now what we need to do is to try to find some other narrative that can collect and hold our identity together. And this is this is why there's the search for the national epic. Mm-hmm. So something a lot of people don't know, you're of course aware of Jakob and Wilhelm Grimm, the brothers Grimm,
yeah,
right? And they're famous for a bunch of fairy tales which they did not write. The fairy tales that we know as like the fairy tales of the brothers Grimm, they were edited mainly by Wilhelm, but they didn't write those stories.
Yeah.
What they did was they went around collecting all the oldest stories, like the children's stories is what they would call them. But they went around just like collecting all the old wives' stories and all the old children's stories and things like this from these tiny little idiosyncratic, you know, valleys in different places in what is now Germany. And they're collecting these stories because the oldest stories preserve the oldest words.
Mm-hmm.
And Jakob Grimm is a philologist. He's interested in really old words. And so his two great works that he composed were the largest and most comprehensive dictionary of the German language which has ever been created. And then also an accompanying volume, sometimes it's called Teutonic Mythology or German mythology or something like that. It's got its own name in German, which I won't try to pronounce here since we're on the internet. But anyway, you've got these two massive volumes. One is This is the German Language, and the other is This is German Mythology. And
yeah,
they're both fascinating works.
And he's going to go through this with respect to the Finns and with respect to Beowulf and a couple of observations with this. One is that, of course, you're looking at barbarians when it comes to language. And when you understand the Bible, I mean, the Bible obviously functions in a similar way a long, long time before the creation of these other national epics. And again, I mean, the whole project of the universal history is that these other epics then find their ways to connect into the Bible. And what these do, obviously, is connect this whole universe of stories within which people can live. And in those stories, you know, we tend to abstract things out like values and ideals, and those kinds of things are all sort of abstracted things, but they live sort of organically here in these stories. But of course, in some way, you know, you have lost something when you have the need of a remedy, and that's when, you know, Grimm collects the stories and the Finns collect their stories, and, you know, people try to figure out what to do with Beowulf. They have a sense of authority of Beowulf. I mean, if these books didn't sort of have authority, but now remember that these are all stories that have just sort of all been living out there in solution, as it were. And what these creators of national epics are sort of doing, like with rock candy, is putting a string in and they're getting crystallized around the string. But that process is also part of modernity, and it's also part of authority, because once you have sort of that string, you are going to have an authority structure. And of course, after the Enlightenment, I mean, this process is going to continue on and on and on and on. But questions of, and of course, when science arises, now we have this massively pragmatic, with this massively pragmatic way of sort of getting what we want. So in the medieval mind of C.S. Lewis, Lewis loves Boethius. Indeed, he thought the ability not just to know, but to love the consolation, to internalize it, was a mark of which side of the great divide your heart was on. Now this great divide, he notes that so Lewis has no problem citing Aristotle and Athenian Plato, not to mention Wordsworth, to help clarify the medieval model. In other words, it was habitual for him to put ancients in dialogue with Christians and medieval Christians in dialogue with the Romantics, despite the intervening millennia, in a way that recall Dante's own blending of various eras, see Inferno 1, where the pilgrim meets the ancient poet Virgil. Thus, despite the intervening years and differences in emotions, Lewis felt them all dedicated to the same project. The real chasm, the great divide, is what separates us, Lewis meant mid-20th century machine-using materialistic modernity, from early 19th century. Just as Christians and non-Christians alike today will talk about light speed or inferiority complexes or the 1% without necessarily being advocates or specialists of Einstein, Freud, or Marx, so too did medieval Christians and ancient pagans share a number of general background beliefs that made them far more like each other than either like a modern man. For this reason, Lewis thought an ancient Roman had more in common with human beings from the 18th century, like, say, Samuel Johnson, indeed, even with Jane Austen, than either of them have in common with us, because, he explained, the old model still underlies their work. For this reason, we can loosely think of Lewis's medieval period as the Long Middle Ages, which extended from Plato to Samuel Johnson, and sometimes even Wordsworth. And, of course, he talks about Boethius. Lewis loved Boethius. Indeed, he thought that the ability not just to know, but to love the consolation, to internalize it, was a mark of which side the great divide your heart was on. Until about 200 years ago, it would, I think, have been hard to find an educated man in any European country who did not love the consolation. To acquire a taste for it was almost to become naturalized in the Middle Ages. In this way, Boethius served as a special exemplar. Just as the 6th century philosopher lived in an age overrun by barbarians, huge fair-skinned, beer-drinking, boasted thanes, and desperately gathered and saved whatever fragments he could from that old high pagan past, so too did Lewis feel it his duty to save not this or that ancient author, but the general wisdom of the long Middle Ages, and then vernacularize it for his world, which is now dominated by a new type of barbarian. His own age was one of proletarianism, which was now, in a way similar to Boethius's barbarians, cut off from the classical past and proud of its distance from classical antiquity. Now, of course, the pride might be, well, those are all dead white men. Oh, okay. We are women and men who have become as practical as irrational animals. And, of course, I was sitting there listening to this on audiobooks, watching the dog and thinking, he's got a point. We need a whole world. It has to all be put together. And you can't just pretend, well, I guess you can go live in the woods if you want to, but it won't be the same as having had to live in the dark forest or live in the black forest, which is disappearing according to some things that I see every now and then. You still have to live in a whole world, and all of these things will have to be balanced. I mean, here we are talking on the internet, talking about enchantments, and while the screens and the computers might feel enchanted, we're all reliant upon the priests who keep the internet up and the eye and the all of the machinery engaged. I mean, my abiding concern is always, again, for the church and its ability to engage with people and to connect with people and for people's ability to live in the church and for the church to not only be plausible and compelling for people. And again, I'm not Roman Catholic, so I'm not... Oh, this is the unmarked up one. You know, it bothers me less in some ways that it's an internet genre, perhaps, because that's probably deeply Protestant, frankly. But, and of course, the Protestants have managed to include the laity. One of the things I find most remarkable sometimes in terms of rubbing shoulders with the Orthodox, maybe I just haven't had enough experience with Orthodoxy, but, you know, and sometimes with the Catholics is just how much is run by the priesthood And of course, one of the values in the Reformed tradition is lay leadership, which of course is a double-edged sword, because chances are, if you're clergy, you have a better chance to have a love and an education in the medievalism that Lewis very much wants to maintain. So, of course, no answers here, but just sort of inklings and wonderings, and sort of using the one-minute manager to not necessarily, not that, not that, not that, not that, just wait through all the not that's and say that, there, over here, that's where to look. More of this, please. There you go. Unedited thoughts. Leave your complaint about my rambling in the comment section. I will read it and chuckle just a bit in an embarrassed way.